they're either intentionally or negligently ignoring the latest climate scientists that say we're essentially going to be losing the sea ice habitat in the coming decades.
The federal government says no to an Endangered Species Act listing for the ribbon seal. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 23rd of December. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, kids in Aleutian Island villages welcome Operation Santa Claus.
The little native boy out there says, you know that you're not Santa because Santa's not white, he's Aleut.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Business Monthly, giving voice to Alaska business.
The federal government has decided not to list ribbon seals under the Endangered Species Act. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says the ice-dependent animals don't face extinction from climate change in the foreseeable future. Conservation groups and at least one biologist are calling the decision disappointing and short-sighted. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Like polar bears, ribbon seals depend on the sea ice for their survival. In the spring, they haul out on ice in the Bering Sea to give birth and fatten their pups. Doug DeMaster is director of the Alaska Fishery Science Center at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He says the ice ribbon seals use is not disappearing at the same rate as the polar bear's habitat.
Ribbon seals, they need sea ice in the spring, but the models suggest that the spring ice conditions aren't going to be detrimental to the point of a risk of extinction or risk of becoming threatened.
Not much is known about ribbon seals. Estimates of their population size are shaky, but the federal government puts their worldwide numbers at about 200,000. And DeMaster says the best science shows the seals don't face a significant threat from global warming.
While the population may go down in terms of it having to work harder to make a living, basically, and not being able to haul out as much, at least from the experts that we've asked and looked at from an agency perspective, the population may go down, but that's different than meeting the criteria to be listed under the Endangered Species Act.
The Center for Biological Diversity filed the original petition to list the species in 2007. Brendan Cummings is the organization's ocean program director. He calls the decision not to list ribbon seals delusional.
I wish I could share the federal government's seeming optimism over its future, but they're either intentionally or negligently ignoring the latest climate scientists that say we're essentially going to be losing the sea ice habitat in the coming decades.
Ribbon seals and polar bears depend on sea ice in different ways. Polar bears use it year-round as a platform to hunt, while ribbon seals use it in the spring for reproduction. But Cummings says despite those differences, the future for both species is bleak.
Even though the ribbon seal is probably equally imperiled as the polar bear, most of America doesn't even know the ribbon seal exists, while they care deeply about the polar bear and its plight. And the fact that the ribbon seal is less well-known is under the radar. The administration was able to simply do what it would have loved to have done with the polar bear, which is deny it protection.
Ribbon seals don't spend any time on land. They leave the sea ice in June after their pups have gained enough weight and pass the rest of the year foraging in the open ocean. Carlton Ray is a professor at the University of Virginia who's been studying the Bering Sea ecosystem for 5 decades. He says he's watched their important ice habitat disappear much earlier than normal in the last 3 years.
The ribbon seal is particularly threatened because of its total dependency on ice and the unlikelihood that it would breed on land. I think the other species may, and I say may, I don't know, but may adapt to land much more easily than ribbon seals will.
And Ray says it doesn't make sense for the federal government to wait until the species has already declined to protect them.
What we're doing right now is taking a big experiment with natural systems, including these seals. We're saying, well, maybe they're not threatened, or maybe it's way in the future. And I'd say that's a dangerous business because what we ought to be doing is taking some kind of action, whatever it is, right now to protect their environment.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is also considering listing ringed, spotted, and bearded seals under the Endangered Species Act. Doug DeMaster of the agency says those decisions will be made independently.
They use ice very differently than ribbon seals, so people shouldn't confuse this as all the ice seals are going to be covered under this one ribbon seal determination.
The decision on whether to list those species is due next spring. The Center for Biological Diversity will ask the incoming Barack Obama administration to overturn the ribbon seal decision. If that doesn't happen, the organization is confident it can win a reversal in court. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Fairbanks and Juneau have been formally designated as non-attainment areas for fine particulate pollution by the Environmental Protection Agency. The Alaska communities are among 46 nationally that have regularly exceeded daily concentration levels set by the EPA for the tiny particles produced by combustion. The area of concern identified by the EPA for Fairbanks includes the cities of Fairbanks and North Pole, as well as Fort Wainwright, Fox, Esther, and the Goldstream Valley. It's smaller than what the agency initially proposed in August. Department of Environmental Conservation Air Quality Division Director Alice Edwards says the area represents a compromise based on input from the state and the borough.
It does not include Allison Air Force Base or the military ranges to the south and east. We were able to show that the way the weather patterns work and the sources from those areas, that those areas did not need to be included in the air in the non-attainment boundary.
Exclusion of Eielson is significant because federally funded projects in no attainment areas are required to undergo more stringent environmental review for air quality impacts. Edwards says the next step is for the borough to continue air quality monitoring to better hone in on the sources of local fine particulate pollution. She says that will lead to a range of regulatory and incentive measures.
You could have burn bans on days when air quality is poor. You can have incentive programs to try and get residents to put in cleaner burning wood burning devices. And the same can hold true for other sources as well. We can look at controls on stationary sources like the industrial facilities. If they are found to be contributing to the problem, we could look at maybe different programs for motor vehicles depending on what sorts of impacts they may be having.
The Fairbanks Borough already has plans to move ahead based on limited air monitoring that points to home heating emissions, particularly smoke from wood and coal stoves and boilers. Borough Mayor Jim Whitaker is working on an ordinance that would offer a tax credit for people to replace heating appliances with cleaner burning models. Whitaker says the tax break is essential, given that a large number of borough residents installed alternative heating systems during the past year's oil price spike.
We don't expect people to have installed a heating system that allowed them to afford heat and then the next year be told that is not acceptable. We're not going to do that. We're going to be very reasonable.
Whitaker says that any incentives or regulation will be thoroughly vetted by the public and there will be sufficient time for compliance. The borough has 3 years to meet the EPA's air quality standards for fine particulates. The standards were tightened in 2006 to reflect new research about the health dangers of the tiny particles, which can become trapped in the lungs. Winter temperatures inversions make the problem worse by holding the particulates near the ground where people can breathe them in. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Juneau residents take advantage of a rare stretch of pleasant weather.
It's our source of vitamin D, I guess. Vitamin H, vitamin hockey.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And by
the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org.
A Fairbanks businessman reported missing last week is dead. 62-year-old Daniel Frederick, a downtown resident who operated the Army surplus and antique shop Blondie's, was found beaten and strangled. Fairbanks Police Chief Dan Hoffman says Frederick's body was located as the result of an investigation of three local men caught using Frederick's credit and ATM cards.
Based upon further interviews and further investigation of this crime, our detectives working in conjunction with the Alaska Bureau of Investigation, which is a division of the Alaska State Troopers, as well as Fort Wainwright's Criminal Investigation Division, ended up locating Mr. Frederick's body, which had been placed in a wooded area off of South Pegger Road.
The three men already in custody for credit card fraud are Raymond Jones, Michael Moore, and Brian Toundrow. Jones and Moore are active duty soldiers at Fort Wainwright. Toundrow was recently discharged from the Army as the result of an unrelated conviction for sexual abuse of a minor. Chief Hoffman would not release additional information about the circumstances surrounding Frederick's murder, but says there's strong evidence tying the suspects to the killing.
Because those charges have not been filed yet, and because of the fact that this case has not gone through the grand jury process yet, I'm not in a position to answer additional questions regarding the motives or the background circumstances surrounding this crime. We just felt it was important to let the community know that Mr. Frederick's body had been found, and we are extremely confident at this point that as a result of our investigation, the three suspects who are in custody are those that are responsible for this murder and will be charged appropriately.
Hoffman says the release of information about Frederick's killing was delayed due to difficulty contacting next of kin in Wisconsin. It's unclear how long Frederick had been missing, but a police press release says his body was moved to where it was found. It also says items from his store were scattered off two area roads. Police believe passersby may have picked up some of the merchandise. Anyone with information is asked to contact Fairbanks Police. The University of Alaska's Institute of Social and Economic Research has just concluded a comprehensive study that looks beyond the usual factors that comprise Alaska's economy. The report is called Structural Analysis of the Alaska Economy: What Are the Drivers? The idea is to parse out the underlying factors of Alaska's monetary foundation. Professor Scott Goldsmith is the lead author of the work. He says although the oil industry represents one-third of the state economy and federal government spending is another third, there are other factors that are not as commonly known.
We did identify some sectors that also people don't think of that much. Retirees, which is a sector that's admittedly quite small, but it's growing very rapidly because we have a large baby boomer population in the state, and they're starting to retire, and they're more likely now to remain in Alaska after retirement than had been the case in the past. The other traditional natural resource industries, fishing, mining, and timber are more important on a regional basis. That is, they support the economies in some smaller places like Dillingham, Sitka, so on and so forth. But statewide, their importance is relatively small, and I think smaller than people realize.
Does it appear that our level of federal funding will probably stay the same? Is it expected to grow or decrease?
Federal spending grew very rapidly in the late 1990s and the first part of this decade. And then in about 2005, they hit a plateau. And since then, they've been fairly constant at about $9 billion a year, which is a lot of money for our state. I don't expect that they will drop precipitously in the coming years, but I do think that they will bounce around that plateau.
I know very little about economics, but it always seems that people speak in terms of diversification is good for long-term stability. How is the state doing in that respect as far as being diversified enough to maintain stability?
I think that it's been a challenge for the state to build a diversified economy away from oil and gas, and we haven't been nearly as successful as we would like to have been. We've spent a lot of money attempting to diversify that has not worked very well. We do have some diversification in the growth of the mining industry, the growth of the tourist industry, the growth of our retiree population, and the presence of the permanent fund, which through the permanent fund dividend provides a diversification to the economy. The challenge we face is that oil is just so much bigger than everything else, that the growth in these other sectors has not been enough to really provide the kind of balance that we need moving forward.
Certainly, Alaska will not be totally unscathed by this economic crisis that's happening much more dramatically in the rest of the country. But what do you think are how skinned up will our knees get in this whole shakedown with the economy?
It really depends on how long the recession lasts and how deep it is, because a number of factors originating outside will eventually have some impact in the state. The overall slowdown is bringing down prices for commodities, not only oil and gas, but also the other commodities that we sell, the fish and the minerals. And so that's going to have some impact, although we have benefited in the last couple of years from very high commodity prices. So some of that is just sort of returning to normal. The fact that there are that people think the economy is going in the tank causes people to be more conservative in their spending. And the more we hear bad news from around the rest of the country, the more that's likely to influence consumer behavior negatively here in the state.
Scott Goldsmith is an economist for ICER. A link to the report is on our website, aprn.org. Alaska's commercial fishing permit holders can now renew their permits and vessel licenses over the internet. The state's limited entry commission staff started up the new online system in late November. According to licensing project leader Yvonne Miller, more than 1,000 fishermen have used it since then.
When we first wrote up our news release, we had about 1,000 people, you know, permits, vessels, and users in there, but it's exceeded that quite a bit now. People are using it from all over the state of Alaska and from down south.
Permit holders and vessel owners have to renew each year to participate in their fishery. They've done that by mail or fax in the past. As part of the new online renewal option, they're able to pay their annual fees with a credit card through the site. The online renewal system provides users with an electronic receipt. Miller says it's secure and very easy to use. She encourages all permit holders to try it.
I think it's great. We've had really good feedback from fishermen. We've had some work with us individually to do some troubleshooting, but it's been extremely helpful. People can sit down, do it in a few minutes. It's very easy, and they don't have to worry about a fax or the mail or anything like that.
The state issues more than 28,000 fishing permits, renewals, and vessel licenses each year. The state is also setting up renewal kiosks at fish and game offices in some Alaska towns. So far, there are kiosks in Anchorage, Sitka, and Kodiak.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo. Manage accounts, pay bills, and get instant loan decisions online at wellsfargo.com. The next stage. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The manager of the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge has received a promotion that will put him at the helm of all 548 refuges in the national system. KBBI's Casey Kelly has more.
Greg Sakanik has been the manager of the Alaska Maritime Refuge for the past 8 years. Based in Homer, the refuge encompasses more than 2,500 islands and nearly 5 million acres from the Aleutian Chain to the Pribilof Islands to areas of the Chukchi Sea. But he says his love for the nation's wildlife refuges goes back to his childhood.
From my perspective, it takes me way back to when I was growing up. I grew up with a place on a lake in Minnesota that was right adjacent to a national wildlife refuge, Tamarack Refuge. And that, I'm sure, really shaped a lot of me because I was out there all the time playing. And you know, we could take a boat down little rivers and get into it.
From there, Sakanik started working as a clerk at the J. Clark Salyer National Wildlife Refuge in North Dakota. His 24-year career includes stints in Montana, Wyoming, and Alaska, including 3 years as manager of the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. He says his varied experiences should serve him well in his new role as the assistant director for the refuge system.
Oh, absolutely. 80% of the lands that the refuge system administers are here in Alaska. So having a good working knowledge of the state of Alaska and all the conservation system units up here will definitely prove to be beneficial.
The job requires Sikanik and his wife, Janelle, to relocate to Washington, D.C., where they spent a few years prior to moving to Homer in 2001. With a son and a daughter in college, he says it's a move they're ready to make personally. But professionally, he felt like it was an opportunity that he just couldn't pass up.
It's sort of been the one position in Washington, D.C. I've been very interested in and have worked towards it certainly over the last couple of years. Had an opportunity to join the Department of Interior's Senior Executive Service Candidate Program, where you spend a couple of years doing various things such as details with other organizations, attending some executive education, doing other types of assignments within the Department of Interior. And then out of that, at the end, you sort of come at this senior executive level, and there's various opportunities. I just happen to be in the right place at the right time.
Sikanik says he's proud of many accomplishments during his 8 years as manager of the Alaska Maritime Refuge. They include the construction of the Islands and Oceans Visitor Center in Homer and responding to the Selandang Ayu shipwreck near Unalaska. One of the most recent projects that he worked on was habitat restoration and the eradication of rats from the once aptly named 7,000-acre rat island in the Aleutians.
Of course, we can't completely claim that for 2 years because we have to go back and do our monitoring work. But, you know, 7,000 acres in the lower 48 is a big refuge on today's standards. So for us to be able to do a restoration of that magnitude will be pretty impressive. And we should get great response. You know, we have all the components of the birds and things that should be using the island are still in and around the area. So we expect to see a pretty happening place from the standpoint of wildlife over the next few years.
He says he'll miss getting out into the field and working on those kinds of projects, but he'll also miss the many recreational activities that Homer and Alaska have to offer.
You know, fishing the Kenai River is going to be a long ways away from Maine Interior Building in Washington, D.C. But on the other hand, I hope to be able to get back on occasion and have those types of activities. Of course, the people in town, I mean, this is I find it to be a very friendly town, made some good friends. I think it's always hard to leave that. But then again, you know, as they say, friendships last a long time. You can make them last forever if you put a little work in it.
Sikanik will leave for his new job in the first part of January, and his wife will follow shortly after. He replaces Gene Haskett, the previous assistant director of the refuge system, who is now the new director of the Alaska region of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. In Homer, I'm Casey Kelly.
Juneau set a new record this fall with 34 consecutive days of precipitation, but last week, day after day of sunny skies sent Juneau residents flocking outside. KTOO's John Ryan filed this audio postcard from the busy ice of Twin Lakes.
My name's Tom Paul. We're at Twin Lakes at the wharf. I'm just getting my skates on and looking forward to an hour or so of fun on the ice. Seems like you could just go on forever without much effort, and I particularly like skating outdoors. You can go a long ways in one direction here at Twin Lakes. What is it, a half a mile or so, maybe a mile, and then and all you can go for a couple miles if you get the right conditions. You don't skate every year because you don't often get a frozen lake that's snow-free, and maybe two or three times a year, and you got to grab the window when you can.
This is Peter Ord, and we're at Twin Lakes playing a little pond hockey with a bunch of pond hockey addicts. Any day that there's ice, there's always a group of guys at noon. A lot of people take off work for a little while. It's our source of vitamin D, I guess, vitamin H, vitamin hockey. This cold snap, they started up Saturday. And okay. So it's been 4 days, 5 days. This is a rare stretch. If we can get 7 days straight, that's rare. And then it might disappear for a month or two or a week, and then maybe we'll get it back again. We mix up our locations between Twin Lakes, Pioneer's Home. We're out of Skater's Cabin, depending where the ice is the best.
And how do you like playing outside compared to playing at a rink?
Oh, this is by far my favorite source of hockey.
Although I play at the rink, but this beats it all.
That audio postcard was produced by KTOO's John Ryan. Operation Santa has been bringing Christmas presents to children in rural Alaska for more than 20 years. This year, KUCB's Ann Hillman got to tag along for one of the stops.
Santa Claus took to the skies and the Aleutians again this year. He decided to forgo the weather-weary reindeer in exchange for a Gorman goose and hopped a flight from Unalaska to Accutan last Friday, bearing boxes of gifts and fruit. 9 kids, including 2 toddlers, looked on patiently as Santa distributed gifts in the schoolhouse.
I got a movie and a thing that transports pictures to your computer.
As 13-year-old Janine Vernon opened her presents, she explained that Christmas was about more than gifts. It's about building relationships with her 4 older siblings.
It's kind of fun to be the youngest. You could torture your older sisters and brothers.
Give me some hints. What should I be doing to torment them?
I tease them. I go knock on their bedroom door and then run away.
But Santa didn't seem to notice that Janine or any others might have been naughty.
That's beautiful. I just like to see the little kids' faces, and I get big hugs and a thank you, and that makes it all worthwhile.
Santa, who resembles Lynn Lewis, said along with some of the hugs, other Santas in other villages received questions.
The little native boy out there says, you know that you're not Santa because Santa's not white, he's Aleut.
14-year-old Sarah Braskin had questions too.
Do you believe in Santa Claus?
No.
It might be because Santa makes 3 public appearances in Accutan each year, at the school's Christmas program, via the Lions Club-sponsored Operation Santa, and at the Safe Harbor Church. Despite that, the kids said it was fun to see him again. But this year's elf, Lions Club District Governor Diana Cummings, said she'd rather have traveled by sleigh.
I've had it, and I probably won't get on another one of those airplanes. Other than that, it was fine. Watching the kids is fun.
Operation Santa also made stops in Atka, Unalaska, and Nikolsky. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Casey Kelly in Homer, John Ryan in Juneau, and Ann Hillman in Unalaska. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Duncan Moon is vice president for media production. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. The Alaska Public Radio Network promotes Alaska's cultures, regions, and ethnic diversity, including a commitment to informing and empowering Alaska's Native peoples. The Alaska Giving Coalition announces Pick, Click, Give, a whole new way to reach out and help Alaskans when you apply for your PFD online. Share part of your dividend with some of your favorite Alaska nonprofits. It's a chance for all of us to come together and give a little extra. Remember, when you apply for your PFD online, just pick, click, give. Information online at pickclickgive.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Giving Coalition.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.